morning, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you are so very, very welcome to Books and Arts Daily here on RN. Today, arts criticism. In the age of social media, anyone can be a critic. Is this the end of informed criticism or the dawn of a new, more democratic conversation about the arts? And two stories about class. Noel Coward's Brief Encounter, a very English love story, now on stage. And first up, one of my best reads for the year, a new novel about class in Australia. It's nice to be with you this morning on RN. Well, back in 2008, it seemed that everyone I met was reading the same book, The Slap, by the Melbourne writer Christos Tsolkas. It was a book which readers felt they just had to discuss, even the ones who were repelled by its rough language and characters that some people found unlikable. That book went on to win several big awards, including the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. Christos's new book is called Barracuda, and I reckon it's set to be equally controversial. Now, it's the story of an Aussie boy named Danny Kelly. His mum is Greek. And his dad is, well, he's a mixture of Irish and Scots, and they're working class people from the Melbourne suburb of Reservoir. That's how you say it if you live in Reservoir, pronounced Reservoir, I guess, or spelt Reservoir. Danny is wrenched from his social class, this working class background, when he wins a swimming scholarship to a very posh school on the other side of the Yarra River. And there he meets the Golden Boys, those boys with perfect skin and rich parents. And there, with access to a top swimming coach, Danny realises that he has what it takes to swim for Australia at the Sydney Olympics. But it all goes terribly wrong. Now, I do need to give a language warning. This book contains the earthiest possible language, as in The Slap. Those two taboo words are part of everyday conversation with Danny and his mates. Christos, welcome to the show.
It's a real pleasure to be on the show, and thank you. You're very kind.
Well, I'm not kind. I'm being honest. I really loved reading this. And I think I love reading it because it shows me a world, perhaps this is egotism coming in here, or ego coming in, a world I feel I know.
And that world is?
The world of class, yes. And class difference in Australia. You know, I really haven't found a book that talks so boldly about the class experience, because we live in a society where there's a kind of myth of classlessness, and we just don't talk about it, do we, as a concept?
Look, I think that myth of classlessness has been a long-standing one. But and I don't think it's an accident that I wrote a book like Barracuda over this period, is that I think class is coming back into the conversation because I think the kind of discrepancies between people's wealth and people's position is becoming starker. I was really conscious of recent conversations. I was in Scandinavia, part of the world I'd never been before, and I was talking with some people in both in Denmark and in Sweden, and a woman had said to me, it really, because Sweden is in a sense the model of social democracy, and she's in her mid-50s, and she said to me, you know, Christos, it's the first time in years that Swedish people have started talking about class. And I think some of those similar tensions are now happening across the global West.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because when you look at one of those charts that shows, you know, the difference between rich and poor, Sweden and those Scandinavian countries are up the egalitarian end, and Australia is gradually moving down the other end. The gap between the rich and the poor is opening wider and wider, isn't it? Yeah. Look, perhaps we should explain to the rest of the world the difference in Melbourne between north of the river and south of the river, because it's a key concept in the book.
Look, yes, the river, the Yarra River, divides Melbourne in terms of class. So south of the river is traditionally seen as the rich part of the world. North of the river is the working class part of the world. But, Michael, one of the reasons I wanted to write Barracuda is to actually indicate that I think some of those definitions and some of those geographies of class are changing as well. That was paramount in my mind of kind of creating the milieu that Danny exists in as well. Like, are the southeastern suburbs south or north of the river? Mm. And some of the real pockets of disadvantage in my city are happening out there. And I think, you know, I grew up, I'm in my late 40s now, and it was very much, I've got this image of the inner city, for example, being still working class and migrant. It's not, and I've realised over the last 5 years, and you know, over the period of writing this novel, that that's no longer true. That where working class communities live in the city, in my city, are elsewhere now.
The other person who writes about class in Australia very well is Tony Burch.
And
Tony Burch grew up in inner city Melbourne, in Fitzroy, in an area he says has now, you know, been occupied by, you know, media types.
Well, yeah, Tony and I've, I think Burch is such a terrific writer, and I think our finest writer about class, really, in this country. It was interesting because I grew up, I was a young kid in an inner city suburb, Richmond, which now seems to have more blondes per square metre than any other suburb in Melbourne. I'm being a
Richmond's also an interesting suburb because it's on the northern shores of the Yarra River, and it's the only place where the very rich can see the working class, because Richmond looks across to posh Toorak. You know, in many ways, the classes are kind of insulated from each other. They don't need to encounter each other in Australia, and the way they do, I think, in other countries. Anyway, let's talk specifically about the story. Danny Kelly, who is he? He's a second generation.
Yeah, look, he's an interesting mix. His mother is she herself is a second generation Australian. Her parents were Greek immigrants. His father is from a Scots-Irish background. His parents come from Glasgow. And there's no accident that I chose Glasgow as the city, I think, because at least for the English speaking world, I think Glasgow represents a particular history of working class identity. And I was very conscious that I wanted Danny's roots to come from that place. Danny is a young kid who has this ferocious will. An incredible ability as a swimmer. And I really, after the slap, Michael, I was really interested in exploring notions of success and failure. I'd had this phenomenal success with the last novel, but I was also a little bit dislocating, to be honest. You know, and why was that? Because, you know, it doesn't matter what the success is when you're a writer or an artist. I think you must know this, both as a writer but also as someone who interviews, you know, people across the arts, that you never can escape that demon on your shoulder saying you're no good.
Yeah.
You know, you've not. This isn't, you know, that you're faking it. It doesn't matter how much you sell. It doesn't matter what the reviews are. And so,
you know, I never quite get this conversation when authors talk about this. I was shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Prize, and I didn't get it. And I never think it would have been a burden to have won. You know, with the best will to the author who did win, I always think I don't feel sorry for her. You know, I don't think, oh, well done.
No, and look, that's a very good point, and I'm not asking people to. Feel sorry for me at all. I think I'm being so fortunate having had the success I had with the slap. Nevertheless, it did bring me to thinking a lot about success and failure. And I became almost envious of the athlete, of the sports person, because it seemed to me that their success was quantifiable. Mm. You know, first across the line is you're the best in your competition. Sports. I'm hesitating because I think that it's possible that sports is a bit of a furthy in terms of how to describe this book. I had a card that I placed above the computer when I first started working, and that card read, "This is a story about how to be a good man," and that's what I wanted. I really wanted this book to be about is actually how a young man who has lived so much of his young life pursuing a dream that doesn't happen, that he feels he's failed himself. He does something terrible, and I think, I mean, truly terrible. I think I'm not going to give it away, but what Danny does is something quite ugly. But I want to ask the reader, can you be forgiven for something like that?
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm talking to Christos Tsolkas about his new book, which is called Barracuda. It's the story of Danny Kelly, who's a very gifted swimmer who comes from a working-class area. And as a result of this freakish ability to swim, he wins a scholarship to a very posh college, to which he gives a very uncomplimentary name. And the tone of the school is really set by boys who are arrogant bullies. white supremacist bullies, I could almost say, and he feels as though he doesn't quite belong and that he's constantly being spotted as the outsider.
Look, one of the things that brought me to writing this book, and again, I don't think it's you know, maybe you map this trajectory in hindsight. Maybe I wasn't clear about this until I finished the final draft of Barracuda. But for the first time in my life, the slap had given me this financial security. And as someone who's very proud of my roots, the struggle and labour of my parents coming to this country, working incredibly hard as factory workers in this country, educating their children, giving me the possibility to go to be something as unbelievable to them as a writer. I had to think hard about where I am now, and the truth is now I'm a middle class man. I'm a bourgeois man. I'm no longer, you know, I share those roots, but I am something else. And maybe what that realization gave me was for the first time I thought I could write about an experience that had really marked me in both positive and negative ways, which was going to Melbourne Uni.
Yeah. And so it's when you go to Melbourne Uni, is it, that you see these golden boys and girls, I guess, of the kind that Danny sees when he goes to the college. It's the first time he sees this other class.
I still remember that you said about being in Melbourne and the river, you know, that in a way we have these mythologies about class because we don't see each other. You know, the people across the river in Toorak don't see the people in Richmond, or that's how it worked in the past. I had no idea that these people existed. Like, I literally had no... I had moved from a heavily migrant inner city school to the outer east, but they were not... They were middle-class kids, but they weren't rich kids. And I just... remember the shock of encountering that world and how confident that world was and how beautiful that world was. I couldn't believe how beautiful people's skin was.
Yeah, one of the curious things that's happened in Australia is that the elite class, the managerial class, the ruling class, call them what you like, once were quite interested in publicity. So there were social pages in the newspapers where the weddings of
so-and-so
were reported, and there were photographs. Or the posh events, such as the Head of the River boat race, when the posh schools race against each other, these were all public events, worthy of public record. Now what's happened is that class has kind of closed the doors, and that what we now report in the newspapers is the marriage of actually television actors, people you and I know, and they're just actors, for goodness sake, but they've been turned into these kind of glittering people, replacing the sons and daughters of the rich.
So that's true.
It's been quite an interesting change of the kind of retreat of the elite from public gaze.
I wonder if in a way they see that as now marking something that is nouveau riche or celebrity culture.
There's something vulgar about seeking publicity. Now, your character Danny and his best friend back from Reservoir, Demet, she's Turkish.
She's Turkish girl.
They both in later life confront each other and realise they've both become middle class. And they wonder whether it was worth it.
Yes.
What's that about when these two think we've lost something? What's that moment about?
Look, I think it was it is a question without a resolution for me, Michael, that, as I said, I'm so grateful for the work that my parents did in getting me to where I am, that I'm talking to you across this table. But at the same time, I feel, and this is where I could, I'm not a champion athlete, so far from it, but where I could understand Danny is that sense of being wrenched from family, from origin, from a coherent sense. I mean, maybe no one has it, but it feels to me sometimes that I've lost a way that my father had of being in his body and in his world that I don't think I have.
I cut you off before when you said above your desk you had this card about this question, what does it mean to be a good man? Does that issue of being wrenched from your working class roots relate to this? Are you asking the question, is it easier to be a good man if you're working class?
I don't think it's as, for me, it's as simple as that. And I think I'm very conscious that I don't want to romanticise a notion of class or of being working class. But I think after running away from this question for a long time, I think that there is a certain dignity and a certain code of honour that both my father has had, my mother has, a lot of their peers have, that I am still struggling with. And even though so much of my my life was spent challenging particular aspects of that code, the having it is something I truly respect, and I feel that has a relationship to something we call working class identity.
Mm. I guess that people who've, or readers of your book, who've actually sent their children to a college like the one you describe, a college that's not that thinly disguised, I have to say, in the book, are going to feel that you've stereotyped the college, because actually it is a place of bullies and snobs.
Oh, look, it is. I mean, I would say that, you know, as I said, one of the things that I wanted to explore is the changing nature of class. You know, these are two characters, a girl from a Turkish background and a boy from a Greek, Scottish, Irish background who can call themselves middle class. That's a change in Australian culture. His first week at the new school, he's teased and mocked and gets into a fight with another Greek boy, who also represents the Golden Boys. So I think there are changes, and I think the novel does reflect some of those changes that are going on in class. Am I being stereotypical? I don't think so, because I think that sense of entitlement, that confidence that that class of people have, has not shifted. I think that is still true.
Across Australia, this is RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. We're talking to Christos Tsolkas about his new book, and we're going to play some music now, and I'm going to get you to talk to me about it off the back of this. The Junction by Squeeze. Why did we play that?
I've had that song has been part of my consciousness for such a long time, Michael. I remember having it on a 7-inch vinyl. We're going back a few decades there. I think it is.
That's a doubly old-fashioned expression, isn't it? 7-inched vinyl.
having said that, I think vinyl has made an astonishing comeback. But in relationship to what we've been talking about, I think Up the Junction, which, you know, it references a classic film from the 60s about working-class life. It is sheer poetry, I think, that the those verses tell us the story of two teenagers who she falls pregnant really young. They try and make a life together. It doesn't work. It's beautiful. It's succinct. It's got a real tragic tone to it, and it's non-judgmental. It's a song that I keep going back to year after year after year as I don't know. How do you write the perfect pop song? I think UK Squeeze did it with that track. How do you write about working class life? I think they did it with that track as well.
Alex is listening to the program. He's tweeted, I'm from Reservoir, and I went to a private school on a scholarship. Very much the outsider! Exclamation mark.
I actually talked to, I've got to say, during the research, because I didn't go to one of those private schools, I did talk to quite a few people who are now my age had had the experience, but I also wanted to talk to young people who were maybe not from that class who were going to those schools. And I was that experience of being an outsider was something that cropped up again and again, Michael. So
I'm going to put something very personal to you. The first time I met you, I remember meeting you at a bookshop. I reckon that was the first time I met you. And I thought, gosh, he's such a polite person. What a polite man. And, you know, you've been very polite here. There's been no language. And yet your writing is so gritty and often takes us into very rough and dangerous parts of experience. And you don't shy away from using vulgar language, rough language in your books. And yet in your conversation, you're perfectly presentable. What's the, what's the story there?
I don't know. The honest answer is I'm not quite sure what the full story about that is. I think I talked earlier about certain codes, a code of honour, and I did get that from my parents, that you treated people with respect until it was shown that they weren't worth it, or that they themselves weren't respectful people. I think I also talked earlier about I didn't want to romanticise the notion of working class identity, and I think that we have we make stereotypes. I mean, you know, you're right to pose the question: am I stereotyping the upper class? But I think we have stereotypes about what working class people are and how working class people behave and how working class people act. Mine always, where I've been really fortunate with the writing is there is an incredible rage that I've had to deal with in my life. And, you know, Danny has that rage in him as well. And for me, writing was the only way, really. I was just trying to think, the only way of being able to tame that and tame that rage.
And can you name that rage?
Can I name it? I think it is feeling. I think it's, for me, it's tied up with masculinity, and it's tied up with feeling hurt. And when I feel that I have been hurt or judged wrongly, I'm going right back when I'm thinking, you know, my immediate reaction is to act. Is violence, whether that violence is in a mental image or a physical reaction. So, I think it's connected to that, and that's why for me, the taming of violence is so much about how to learn to be a man. I mean, for me, where I'm completely different with Danny, I think, is, you know, Danny, what he does in the novel is he hits out at someone else. I think the way what I did with that rage was to turn it, internalise it onto to myself, and I think a lot more men do that. And the stories we keep hearing, the stories of the ugly violence that men do, and that's undeniably true. But I think most of in the majority, the violence that men do is to themselves.
So when you wrote that first novel. Mm-hmm. I can never remember what's the novel and what's the film.
Loaded was the novel, yeah. Head On was the film.
Loaded. That was an expression of rage, was it? Were you actually slapping respectable society when you wrote that book?
Oh, look, you know, obviously, when I was writing Loaded, I know now that I had very, very little idea of what it meant. You know, when you write your first novel... You don't know that you will ever ever have the opportunity of doing this again. So you kind of put everything you want to say into that book. And yeah, I just wanted to kick out at everyone there. You know, it was the Greek community, it was the gay community, some of the piousness of middle class attitudes.
You offended everybody.
Yes. I did not sit down and say, I am going to write a book that's going to offend everybody. But I sat down and wrote a book that allowed me to express some of that anger.
And that anger's still here, isn't it? I mean, in Barracuda, there's still...
Oh, yeah.
It's still there.
It is, except now that it's kind of what... There were really, and it's, you know, the reality is going back to your past work is really hard. You're just conscious of how much you didn't read when you wrote it. But I think there was tenderness in that first book, but it was so submerged. Whereas there were very small moments. Whereas I think there. I was 46 when I started writing, 45, 46 when I started writing Barracuda, and though I had to get into Danny's mind and I had to understand that rage, and I do think I still do understand that rage, I was also an older man looking at this character, and I just wanted to protect him. And that's the difference, I think. I didn't know that when I was writing Loaded all those years ago. Mm. But, I want to protect someone like Danny, because that's not to say that I think he has to make atonement for what he does in the novel, but I can't throw him away. I can't let him go.
Well, it's just great being on this journey with you. Moving from one book to the next, and I'm so thrilled about the latest one. It's not going to make everybody happy, but it is one of my reads for the year.
Again, thank you, mate. I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you for coming by. Christos Tsiolkos. Christos Tsiolkos' book is called Barracuda, and it's published by Allen & Unwin. You're on Books and Arts Daily. Next up, critics. Is there still paid work for critics now that we can all have our say thanks to the internet? Well, there was a time when arts criticism was a very serious business. Newspaper critics were a feared bunch. Arts and theatre critics could make or break a show. They could propel or kill a career. But as the traditional newspapers go out of business, I don't suppose they'll all go out of business, but they're certainly struggling, what's the future for the critic? Is arts criticism just moving off the page and into the digital world? And what possibilities does this digital world offer? Who's it for? Joining me now to discuss the future of arts criticism is culture writer Jane Howard, who writes primarily about the performing arts. Jane, it's nice to have you here.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
And also Yun-Chol Kim, who's professor at the School of Drama at the Korean National University of the Arts, and he's president of the International Association of Theatre Critics. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you here. So how has arts criticism changed in the last 10 to 15 years, Yun-Chol? How's it altered?
Yes. The one of the biggest changes should be the shift of the attention to the web, to the internet criticism from the print criticism, and it's really shocking to see the speed of the reduction of critical space in conventional print media, and it is also replaced by the web criticism.
When you say it's shocking, are you saying it's a bad thing, it's a great loss?
It's both. It's good and bad in terms of, because, we have very active and lively discussions on the internet space. That's good part. The other part is, the criticism in the internet is lacking some kind of expertise and real considered judgment, and that's a real problem. And the one bad influence of that kind of, opinion blotters is that it influences the box office and it influences the artistic quality of the performers. That's the bad thing.
So the argument against this is that in the old days when you had one critic, mm-hmm. one especially in theatre, you had one theatre critic who was expressing his or her opinion on every show. That gave that person immense power.
Yeah.
And they could actually close a show, which, mm-hmm. If there'd been a different critic with a different set of tastes, might have prospered.
I think you have a very good point. But that particular critic has been working for theatre and has been writing for theatre reviews for decades. And his knowledge, his contextualization could be very reliable. And that's good for the theater art in general. But in terms of the theater bloggers, we need some kind of influence from the expert. And the experts, traditional or conventional experts, are very reluctant to engage in this blogging. And that's the problem. And the future of criticism should be related to how we accommodate this new culture, this new web culture.
Let's talk to Jane. Jane, you started as a blogger.
Yep.
You're now writing for The Guardian. Did you feel the need of expert critics to show you the way, or were you forging your own path valiantly into the digital future?
Very much. It was forging my own path. It started as a hobby, though. And, I mean, definitely the stuff that I wrote the first few years I was blogging was rather awful. But I think you have to find your way by putting your work out in front of the world. And I think...
Why were you doing it? Because no one's paying you to do this.
Yeah, just... Well, because I loved and I still love theatre, and I love... analysing the world, and because I love theatre, I loved analysing theatre.
And when did you know people were reading your opinions?
Oh, they didn't for a long time. And then...
So why did you keep going? Why does someone blog when they're getting no feedback?
I think it is just about that sort of... When it started for me, it was a very personal experience. It was about, well, I love theatre and I think theatre is important and I want to analyse it. That's sometimes hard to do over a drink, or if you see a show by yourself, you can't do it. And writing is a good way for my brain to work things out. So it was all about me at the beginning.
I didn't get this, actually. I was on a panel to peer review one of the theatre companies, and after a show, I would have to write a little page commentary on what I'd seen. No one else saw it. It just went, you know, to the theatre company. I think it was as part of the Australia Council process.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually found that writing down what I'd seen and reflecting on it was... Well, it was an education for myself because it helped
absolutely.
Me clarify my ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can clarifying, I think, is a really good word. I wrote a review the other week, and it was only partway through writing this review that I actually realised how powerful the work was. It was the process of analysing it that brought the work out for me.
Yes, if you say I've got to take a position here, you really do have to think through where you stand. Now, you've got picked up, if that's the expression, by The Guardian. So the British newspaper The Guardian has moved into Australia and recruited lots of Australian talent for their online, for their Australian version. This was during the Adelaide Festival. How did this happen?
I was very lucky. Before Guardian Australia even launched, The Guardian UK sent a team out to cover the Adelaide Festival. They had a media partnership and they wanted to have a local person who can both sort of contextualise where the art sat in an Australian context and be a bit of a tour guide for the city. So I spent 3 weeks working full-time with the team, and then I got to start freelancing for Guardian Australia.
Right. Now, you're here on the show this morning with Yun Chol Kim, who's professor of the School of Drama at the Korean National University, and he's just been saying that there is this kind of balancing we need to do between what's been lost in expertise as the power of the newspaper critics declines, as opposed to some kind of opening up of the conversation. How do you score that balance sheet?
I think opening up is crucial. I think one of the problems when you only had one critic, or even if we still look at mainstream media, a lot of the time the critics, and like you're saying, they sort of have one particular point of view. And so what if the play is, or whatever it is contemporary and it's experimental, and it's, say, I write a lot of criticism which has a lot of feminist politics in it about the theatre, and if a play is a very feminist play and the critic is a 70-year-old man who's never been part of that world...
A grumpy old man.
Yeah. And so I think we need, but I mean, you know, the grumpy old man might need to review for the other grumpy old men.
Well, I suppose that's right. Yes, I suppose the question that ultimately Yung Chol, is how do we train critics? Because you're saying that we don't want to lose the expertise that this more traditional critic has. What's a good grounding for a critic? What's a good training for a critic?
I am teaching criticism in my school for several years, and I'm also, the IATC has a training, the Young Critics training program, which is called Young Critics Seminar.
The IATC is the International Association of Theatre Critics, of which you're the president.
And what you try to help them, help young critics to be more, you know, responsible, to be more objective in their reviewing, is that we first want them to be open-minded to any kind of new happenings in theatre.
What does objective mean? How can a critic be objective?
This could be fair or logical. You know, the critical reviewing is a kind of, you know, communication art. You should be very logical. You should be very persuasive.
Right. What happens, Yung Chol, if you go to a play, and I'm sure we've all had this experience, you go to a play and you think, oh, this is awful. Mm-hmm. This is just awful. And at the end, everybody's on their feet cheering, and you think, oh, my Lord, the audience love it. I'm all alone here thinking it. What's your responsibility then as a critic? Should you be truthful to your own response, or should you say, clearly, I've got this wrong, the audience love it? That would be the objective thing to do.
Yes, yeah, you're right, but that's a very embarrassing and very difficult moment for a theatre critic, you know. But we have so many cases of that kind. And the people nowadays do not particularly respect the artistic theatre. And they like to have some popular theatre, and there is some conflict between them. And what I like to do as a critic is to why we should like this play or why we should not, giving some reasons for that, artistic reasons, some context of the show, you know, without comparing with other, you know, phenomena around the world and etc. And if I can persuade the audience why it should be considered the other way, it is success. But if not, it's my failure. My failure as a critic to persuade my opinion, which I consider to be very objective and very fair. But nowadays, you know, this expertise is considered to be elitist.
Elitist, which has become a dirty word.
Yeah, that's the word.
So do you think that the critic has a job to educate taste?
Definitely, I do.
Right, because the critic is a person who is practiced or educated in knowing how to respond to this work of art, and people who don't get why this is good, he can open their eyes and minds to the experience, he or she.
Yeah.
Now, where do you stand on that, Jane?
I think definitely you have to stick to your guts when you're reviewing a show. If you didn't like it, everyone else did, or if you did like it, no one else didn't.
Stick to your guts. Is
that
what you said?
Yeah, what you feel, I think. I never use the word objective with my criticism. I always say it's subjective, and that's part of the reason
it's
that I think
subjectively objective.
But that's one of the reasons we need so many people, and that's why I think lots of bloggers is exciting, because you have more eyes, and then in talking about opening your eyes up and sharing something, I think that goes both ways, and hopefully what we'll see more and more of with criticism as it engages more and more with the digital space is the audience talking back and everyone expanding their knowledge base.
I think there's a false dichotomy here between the idea that you have one god critic or you have a great mass of people all expressing their opinion.
Oh, I'm on the mass side.
But in a way, perhaps that's not the choice, because theatre has always been an unusual art form in that a newspaper would have one theatre critic, sometimes two, one music critic, sometimes two, but you never have one book reviewer on a newspaper. All sorts of people are recruited to write book reviews, and I've never quite understood why it is like this. It seems to me that in any town there are plenty of people who could write informed criticism, not millions, but 20, 30, who could be enlisted to write an account of a play, just as we trust people to write accounts of books. I mean, why can't it work? Why can't it work like that, Professor? Or can it?
I think because of the influence of the profit engineered industry of media, that is the strongest block to the. But on the other hand, the I think the conventional, the old traditional critics have lost their way to communicate with contemporary people. That's why I like the Alyssa Solomon, who is the Columbia University professor, who has long been a theater critic for Village Voice, said she's trying to create a new form of criticism, which is a combination of narrative and critical analysis. And that's a good story. It is, I think, good experiment as a critic to be a storytelling criticism. I like that idea very much, and I am trying to find it. You know, because we theater critics should feel a lot of responsibility for this kind of situation we are facing now, because we lost the contact with the ordinary people. We are immersed, we are absorbed in our professional jargons, which do not communicate at all. So we need to have a very genuine communication with this kind of new experiment in theater criticism. And this has not been happened to the criticism world so far. That's the failure. We must apologize. We must, you know, confess. And that's what you need to do in the future.
On Books and Arts, we're talking about the future of criticism, particularly theatre criticism, with the advent of online criticism, which means that anyone can have their say. And I'm talking to Yun Chol Kim, who is president of the International Association of Theatre Critics, and also to Jane Howard, who has been a theatre blogger and also works for The Guardian Australia. Yun Chol, you've drawn up a code of practice for your members.
Yeah.
This is at the International Association of Theatre Critics. And I love point six. Point six in the code of practice says this. Take note, Jane. Theatre critics should strive to come to the theatrical performance in their best physical and mental condition and should remain alert through the performance. Yeah. That is, don't go to sleep.
I've spotted some critics in the audience asleep at shows before, and then it's always interesting to read their reviews.
Okay. Oh, you see, you dozed off, want to say.
Yeah.
You want to tweet, he dozed off. Yeah. And come in your best physical and mental condition. What does that mean? Don't have a jar or two before you go into the theatre.
I guess, don't be hungover.
Who's the reviewer responsible to? Let me rephrase the question. What's your responsibility to the artists themselves? Do you have a responsibility to the people who are in the show?
Of course, I feel that way. Because, you know, the most important, you know, mission for criticism is to enhance the quality of the art. And we should know how to communicate with the artist as well as with the audience. But the best thing, my personal primary goal is to trying to enhance the quality, the standard of performance by giving them a very critical analysis, scientific and storytelling. Yeah, it should help.
Well, that's a nice point to end on. I've got to thank you both for coming in. It's been a very nourishing conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jane Howard is a freelance culture writer. She's based in Adelaide, primarily writing about the performing arts. And she's now a regular contributor to The Guardian Australia. And Yun Chol Kim is a professor at the School of Drama at the Korean National University of the Arts. And he's also president of the International Association of Theatre Critics. And both are just warming up for a forum called Criticism in the Digital Age. That will be at Melbourne's Wheeler Centre this coming Thursday night. Across Australia, this is Books and Arts Daily. I'm Michael Cathcart and you're on RN.
Come on a landmark journey deep into the art of Australia.
One of the great icons of Australian art.
Starting tonight, Edmund Capon explores the art and artists that have helped transform our country from convict colony to cultured nation.
Brilliant.
The epic three-part series.
The story of the art of Australia.
Starts tonight, 8:30, ABC One.
Yes, that's coming up tonight. Now, when you hear the name Noel Coward, what do you think of? That languid Englishman who starred in so many black and white films, or the light comedies that Coward wrote for the stage? Well, one of his standout plays isn't a comedy at all. Coward wrote Still Life in 1936, and a decade later, it was made into a fabulous film with a new title, Brief Encounter, and by any measure it is one of the great British films. It's a story about passion, duty and sacrifice of an oh-so-British kind. Well, now Britain's Knee-High Theatre Company has brought its acclaimed new take on Brief Encounter to the Melbourne Festival. The stars explain the story to James Patterson.
Hi there, my name's Jim Sturgeon, and I'll be playing Alec Harvey in the play.
Hi, I'm Michelle Nightingale, and I play Laura Jessen.
Laura and Alec are thrown together in a completely unlikely scenario. Who are the two, and what causes them to meet?
They're two very ordinary people who meet in a quaint little English tea shop at a train station.
It all started on an ordinary day in the most ordinary place in the world, the refreshment room at Milford Junction.
Laura gets a bit of grit in her eye from a passing train.
Can I help her?
No, please, it's only something in my eye.
Try pulling your eyelid down as far as it'll go.
And then blowing your nose.
And as a doctor, I go to help.
Please let me look. I happen to be a doctor.
That's very kind of you.
There's a little connection, there's a little spark.
That's how it all began. Just through me getting a little piece of grit in my eye.
And then, just by chance, they meet again on the street, and then again another time in a restaurant. So it's all very, you know, these chance meetings, and I suppose there's that thing in Alec's heart of, you know, this can't be luck, this has to be fate, and I should pursue this and follow this. But the thing is, they're both married to other people.
I'm a happily married woman. Or rather, I was until a few weeks ago. But, oh, Fred, I've been so foolish. I've fallen in love.
Our sort of love story is the really sort of heartbreaking, sad one, because you can see this marvellous connection between these two people. But then you also realise that they've got some big decisions to make. And, of course, back in, you know, where it's set in 1938, it was very improper to just leave your spouse and your family and pursue love somewhere else. So it's really quite heartbreaking in that respect.
It causes a dilemma, and it causes, you know, quite a lot of heartache at the end of the film. At the end of the play.
It's a confusion that's understandable because this stage performance isn't only based on the original film from the 40s, it's really a tribute to the film and to the works of Noel Coward in general, and it has a lot of fun with it. To say the least, it's a very hammed-up version of the original. Throughout the show, characters literally jump in and out of a huge silver screen that's up on stage and become part of the action in front of us. Sure, there's the pain of the affair between Alec and Laura, but the stage show is basically a comedy. And there's two characters in particular who are a lot of fun to watch. That's Albert Godby, played by Joe Alessi, and Myrtle Baggett, played by Annette McLaughlin. Here's Joe Alessi.
There are three love stories within the piece. Obviously, the main one is between, you know, Alec and Laura is the main story. But there are like satellites, two other love stories going on around it. And there is a love story between Stanley and Beryl, who are the very young ingenue couple who are just starting out, that kind of first faltering steps into love. And then ours is the kind of second time round, if you will.
Myrtle runs the Station Cafe, which is where a lot of our story is set. She's a very independent woman who's been married before. And Albert is the ticket inspector.
Yep.
And they have a kind of cat and mouse kind of...
Cheekiness
love story that interwines throughout the story of our main protagonists.
Give us a kiss.
Well, do no such thing. The lady might see us.
Come on, a quick one across the bar.
Albert, stop it.
Come on, there's a lot.
Let go of me this minute.
Never.
Albert! Now look at me, Banbury's all over the floor.
1, 2, 3. 2, 2, 3. She is so good at love. Her heart is so wise and free.
This great song and dance number between the two of you, which has taken the original 1945 film and all the tension that I saw between your two characters and just exploded it into something else.
Now then, Albert Godby, you behave yourself. We don't want the old station laughing at us.
What's there to laugh at?
Albert Godby!
How do you feel?
Don't talk so soft!
Joe, you're
covered in lipstick.
Yes, I am, yes.
And that's nothing to do with me, it's just how he likes to dress.
Yeah, I saw you rubbing all the lipstick all over your head before.
We have our director's taken, adapted our production from the film and from the one-act play called Still Life. So in our version, our characters have a lot more involvement in the story. And being a knee-high show, we have interwoven music and dance. And so what you just experienced was our dance of love at the end, which, gets quite passionate.
Well, I am...
We pash. This is an Australian thing. Yeah, I've never heard it
before. Pash
so we
before.
Have a good old pash.
And that's right. It's very much an adaptation of the original story. Of course, what we do, though, is pay absolute respect to Noel Coward's script. You can't mess around with that. So we have Noel Coward's story and Noel Coward's script, and we also add in a lot of his poetry, and we set that to music.
And, of course, it was only a one-act play to begin with.
Still Life.
It was part of Tonight at 8, and it was just a one-act play. But, yeah, as Joe said, he's a genius, and so the script stays the same. And then we've interwoven Noel Coward music and some of his poems set to knee-high composers' music. It's a real feast for the senses.
Absolutely. It's a real celebration of theatre. If you love theatre, you'll love this show. So, yes, it's very much an adaptation, but the central core, the central story of Alec and Laura, that terrible, painful love story, the story of forbidden love, it's still there. But what we bring to it are feelings and metaphors, so you get multimedia to suggest how Laura's feeling within. You get people flying through the air, live music. I mean, we throw everything but the kitchen sink at it. But Noel Coward's wonderful script keeps it up there and keeps it bubbling.
Now, before you mentioned that the word pash is new to you, obviously you're new to Australia, but you're not new to this play. The two of you have been part of this play for quite a while, haven't you? Yeah. This has gone through the West End and Broadway.
Broadway, a US tour as well. It's been a real fantastic, a wonderful experience for me and Netsy because we've done pretty much most of it.
How long has the involvement been for you two?
I think since 2008.
It's very rare in this business that you get to go to so many amazing places with a show that you adore so much. You know, it's kind of... Every experience we've had with the show has been different because we've had different people and different energies in the show. So it keeps it moving and growing. And then we get to go to places like this.
Like
and
Melbourne.
We get paid to be here and we have great fun. And, yeah, we're very, very lucky.
Finally, what does Brief Encounter say about love at all stages of your life?
Of course it conquers all, but it also can't be sometimes. So Brief Encounter just, it shows what a celebration love can be and also how impossible it can be as well.
So that love for Alec and Laura, they show each other different sides of themselves. Laura, she's just lost things a little since she's been married, and the same with him, and they explore those other sides of each other and they find the love within themselves, I think. And, you know, it's... sort of showing sides of each other through love, maybe, to let go and be the person that you want to be.
James Patterson speaking with the stars of Brief Encounter, Jim Sturgeon, and Michelle Nightingale, a new adaptation of Noel Coward's play. And you can see Brief Encounter at Melbourne's Athenaeum Theatre. It's part of the Melbourne Festival. It's there until the 27th of October. And then it plays Sydney, Wollongong and Perth. And we'll put details of those dates on our website. And let's make a promise that we'll all use the word pash a bit more often, because it's a good Aussie word. It's an evocative Aussie word. That's the show for today. Tomorrow, lots of music. We're talking to the popular singer, Tina Arena. She'll be joining us. And the composer of Les Miserables, called Michel Schoenberg. He reflects on the success of that musical, which is set to return to the Australian stage. But now it's time to talk to Gam Wilson about... what is this, potatoes underground and tomatoes above, one plant?
Yeah, it's a chips and sauce plant.
No.
It's been developed. The New Zealanders have come up with it. Just been released in
the last
couple of weeks.
They're pulling your leg.
No, they're not. Apparently amateur grafters have been trying to come up with this plant for years, and it's been done now, and it's on its way to Australia. So we'll tell you all about
potatoes
it.
Potatoes underground and tomatoes on top.
Yeah, cherry tomatoes on top. Stay with us. I'll tell you more very soon.
Good Lord. That's Bush Telly coming up straight after the news. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is RN. Bye-bye.
As seen on ABC One, Big Name, No Blanket documents the extraordinary life of the frontman of the pioneering Australian rock group, the Wurrumpi Band.
Listen, everybody! He was a musician, a dancer, a hunter, a great teacher.
I want to educate black and white. That's why I believe there's the two worlds in me.
Big Name, No Blanket. The story of George Wurrumbi. Available from ABC Shops, Centres and ABC Shop Online.